at the beginning, let me just
recapitulate what we have done yesterday. So we started with an introduction to differential geometry, and the central object is that of a manifold. And so manifold is basically a set of points. So if I take any point on that manifold, I'll find a neighborhood of that point, which is mapped to the N. And so I use the letter psi, which is like a chart, but let me just be a physicist and let's use the letter x like a coordinate x. So this is mapped to x of p, x mu of p, and there's some neighborhood of that point. So this is a coordinate system x. And so for every point, you can find such a region where the point P is contained, and there's this map X. But if you have another coordinate system, then there is also a map R to the N, now X prime of P. And so manifold is nice and smooth, so that if there is this overlap in between the two coordinate systems, then the corresponding map from one R to the N to another R to the N is smooth. Okay, and so this is basically the structure of what you mean by manifold. Okay, so now you can also define on manifold, you can define a function. So for a given P, I can define F of P, which is a map to the real numbers. Is a function, and if you change the coordinate system, of course it doesn't matter. So for a given p, it gives you the value, so let's say 5, and it doesn't matter in which coordinate system you describe this. And so from there it follows that f of p, well, that f in one coordinate system is the same thing as f in another coordinate system. So it's still the same value, because it only depends on this point P. Okay. So now, an important object which can live on the manifold, sort of, is a tangent vector. And so you can think about it, this is my manifold, I have some point here, and I raise a tangent sheet to my manifold at that point, and this will be a linear vector space, and you can equip this vector space with a basis, which I denoted, let's say d over dx1 and d over dx2. Of course, the basis doesn't have to be orthogonal. It can be anything, as long as it is, you know, as long as it spans the whole vector field, vector space, you are okay. So this is a point P. So this is T P of M. It's called that vector space. And now, if I have any vector living in that vector space, I can write it as a linear combination of the basis vectors. So V is just d mu, d over dx mu. Of course, the basis, you don't have to have only two, but you can have many up to n. Okay, so this is the components, and this is the basis. And so what is amazing about this object is that it's an invariant object. It doesn't matter, again, which coordinate system you use. And so to find how this object looks in a different coordinate system, it's still the same object, still the same V. It's an invariant thing, but you can just use the chain rule. And that's the fastest way how actually you can find how the vector looks in a different coordinate system. So we will practice that in today's tutorial. So usually people just use, you know, the transformation law for components, but that's not the fastest way. and you can make mistakes. So it's better to actually do it through this chain rule with the invariant object. And so you have them by the chain rule is d x prime nu prime dx mu d over dx prime nu prime is in new coordinates, and this is what you call the nu prime x prime. So this is how the component would transform, but it's really better for a given vector, just use the chain rule explicitly on that given vector and do it. Okay, so that's what a tangent vector is. And there is also its dual, a cotangent vector. Or a one form. And so that also lives in its own vector space, which is now called the star P of M. And you can equip this vector space with another basis. So say dx1, again, it doesn't have to be orthogonal, dx2, and then the element of this vector space, let's call it omega. It's just a linear combination of these basis vectors. So omega is just omega mu dx mu, where again this is the basis, and these are the components. Okay. And again, this object is completely invariant object. So if you want to know how it looks in different coordinate system, you just use how this guy, how the basis transforms under the change of coordinates. So omega mu, dx prime nu prime, dx nu, and this is what you will call omega nu prime at x prime. It's again how the components transform. And again, this is the fastest way how you can get omega in different coordinate systems. Don't use this thing, but really use how the differential transforms. It's the best way. You look suspicious. Okay. Okay. So now, from what I'm saying here, it's obvious that objects, vectors, v, and covectors or cotangent vectors, omega, they are different objects, right? They live in a different space. They have nothing to do with each other, sort of. This is usually confused, you know, in basic courses in, let's say, on special relativity, where you can sort of trade one object for another object. You can rise index, lower index through the metric. But in general, this is not the case. You don't have metric in general, and you cannot rise or lower indices. And there's no way to connect these two spaces in some sense. The only connection is through the definition of the dual basis. Okay, so just let me stress that. So omega and v are different, very different objects. And in general, there's no way to, you know, to change one to another. But there are spaces, and then in particular, they live in a different space. But the spaces are connected. Yeah, not very connected, but through the defining relation between the what you mean by the basis. So dx mu d over dx nu equals to delta mu nu. So this is the only connection between the spaces, if you want. And it tells me, you know, if I have one basis, let's say in tangent space, then I define the other basis in the cotangent space by this relation. Yes?
So if I have an arbitrary tangent vector at a point, can I always choose local coordinates such that the vector is one of the basis vectors or something?
Well, you can just change coordinates, yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. I think so. Is that true? If I have a vector, maybe some integrability conditions. Okay, probably yes, but yeah, let me think about it. Yeah. All right, so questions to this. Okay, so that's what vectors and covectors are. So now if you take a product of these objects, you get what a tensor is. So tensor and then let me do it again. So of type K and L. And rank, so this is a definition, what do you mean by rank, and what do you mean by type. And so basically for rank, you just sum the two numbers which you are given here, K plus L, is a multilinear map and so you go from TP star of M K times and then L times, so this is K times and then you go from TP of M L times to real numbers. So a tensor eats vectors and eats one-forms and gives you a number. So just to have an example, I don't know if it eliminates anything, but let's say type 2 and 1, which means it's rank 3. So then you can write this tensor basically as a tensor product of two vectors and one covector. So that means you can write a T, it will have three slots, two vector slots and one form slot. And then you have the basis, dx alpha, and then there's this funny sign standing for tensor product, and dx beta, and dx gamma. So what I mean by this thing, I'll sometimes use this thing, so what it means is just d over dx alpha. Okay? It's just shorter to write. So now, this is your basis now, and these are the components. Okay, so now it's obvious that I can feed this tensor. So the tensor has three slots now, alpha, beta, gamma, 1, 2, and 3. So definitely the one form slot can eat a vector, and the vector slot actually can eat a one form. So you can feed it one form, another one form, and a vector, and it gives you a real number. Okay, so that's what it is. So now from this, it's obvious how the tensor transforms. Again, you can take any tensor, forget about the components, and just transform the basis according to the chain rule or how the differential transforms. Right? And this is how you get how the tensor looks in a different coordinates. But again, the tensor itself is invariant object. There is no, okay. Right, questions? So now with tensors, you can do some operations. Something called tensor algebra. So you can sum tensors. So let's say I have tensor T plus tensor S. So if they are of the same type, meaning they have the same K and the same L, I can sum them together. So if same type. Meaning also the same rank. Then there is this operation which I'm already using that. There is the tensor product. So tensor product, it's this funny notation here. And so basically what it does, it creates bigger tensors. So So creates bigger tensors. And basically how you apply this operation is that you put one tensor and you place next to it another tensor. Okay, so let me do an example. So we already have this tensor T, which is this 2-1 tensor. So example, so I'll take the same T, but I will take another tensor S. Let's say this will be just a one form. So S delta TX delta. So now I'm interested in what happens if I tensor product T with S. Okay. So now what it means is that I just write the two tensors next to each other. So which means I have this thing, T alpha beta gamma dx alpha dx beta d x gamma. Then I put this sign here, and then S delta dx delta. So this is what you are trying to find. So now, of course, this is just a component, in some sense, a number. So it doesn't care about this thing. So this tensor operation only works on the basis. So I can move this guy up to here. So this will be equal to T alpha beta gamma S delta. And then I just put an additional thing. So it's dx alpha dx beta dx gamma dx delta. So now this is my new basis. And these are my new components, which you will call T, S, and then the components alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. Yes?
I don't understand why we're writing the basis beside the tensor. Like, isn't the tensor just the object T with the indices? And then why write the basis?
Okay. So it depends on what notation you are using. So in my notation, the tensor is really the invariant object, which means it has its own basis and it has some components. It's really, so vector is really a vector. It's not just a set of numbers, but it's really a direction if you want. And then you need the basis because you have, it's a linear combination of some basis vectors. And so, yeah, so in that notation, so yeah, so this would be the tensor. This would be just the components of the tensor. Sometimes people confuse these things and they just work with components and they forget, you know, well, they don't care that there's some basis. But of course the components change, and the change of coordinates, the components do change, whereas the tensor itself does not. So you see that now we have an object which has four slots. So by this tensor product, we created a 2-2 tensor. So really the tensor product, you know, creates bigger tensors. So you have, yeah. Okay. So now there is in some sense an inverse operation, which is the contraction. You can contract two tensors, but let me do it first for one. So again, so this is to create small tensors. This is very, very crude. So anyway, so I have my tensor T alpha beta gamma, again, dx alpha, dx beta, dx gamma. And at some reason, for some reason, I may decide, well, so this guy lives in one space, this guy lives in another space, and this guy lives in third space. But I can at some point decide, well, why don't I connect these two spaces and let this one form to act on this vector? Okay, so you can connect these two. Which means I really do dx gamma on dx alpha. But from this definition over here, it is just delta gamma alpha. Okay, so which means, okay, so it's just a number. I can now put that number here. So this is T alpha beta gamma delta gamma alpha. And then this guy is left, and these guys kill each other. So it's just T x beta. That's what's left here. So now delta just changes one index to another one, so it's just changes gamma to alpha. So this is T alpha beta alpha d x beta. So now you are summing over this alpha. So you are basically tracing this tensor. You are summing over its components. But in the end, you see that you have only one slot there. So this is one zero tensor. And so you can easily write this as v beta dx over d beta. And so you created out of the tensor which was rank 3 originally, now you created a tensor which is rank 1. So the contraction kills some slots. And you can, of course, you can contract only if indices which where one of them is up and one of them is down. You cannot contract these two indices because, you know, there's no way I can actually contract these two because they don't like each other. They don't talk to each other. Okay, unless you have a metric, but you don't in general. Okay, and so similarly, so this was for one tensor, but you can do a contraction of two tensors. So let's say I take some indices of one tensor and contract it with some indices of another tensor. So the simplest example would be I take a vector and I contract it with a one form. And so this is defined simply that the one form eats that vector. And you can write it as V alpha omega alpha, and it's a number. And similarly, you can do for high rank tensors. So just, you know, contract the indices. Take a tensor product of those and contract some of the indices. Okay. So that's basically a tensor algebra. And you'll have some practice on this today, so don't worry. But all the operations actually are much more easily done when you do them in the form where you really write the whole invariant object, not the components. Yes?
Is there like a mathematical notation to say that V is just the contraction of the first and the third index of T? Instead of writing it out in English?
This is the notation. You would just do this. If you wanted to contract the second and third, you would swap these two, right? So that's the notation if you want. But I don't know how to do it here invariantly. I don't know. I have never seen that. It's an interesting question. I don't know. just a second. So this will be the contracted one. Okay, so this is T. So this is T contracted. Contracted would be this thing here. Okay, sorry, it's not. I'm not continuing the equality. So this is the original T, but now I connect these, and I get T contracted. And now, okay, questions. This is all you need to know about tensors, basically. Very good. So now it was part A in the differential geometry. So let me start part B, which is a Lie derivative. And so the whole problem is how to differentiate tensors on a manifold. How to differentiate tensors on M, on a manifold. And of course, why you want to do that is that in the end, you want to write down some field equations or equations of motion. And so these will involve tensors. And you want to write some differential operator acting on these tensors and solve these differential equations to get something, right? So you need to know how to differentiate these things. And so just compare this. So we may now start with a naive thing. So let me take a function of one variable in real numbers. And so you know that df over dt at some point t0 is just defined as a limit s goes to 0 f t0 plus s minus f t0 divided by s. So this is a standard definition for a derivative of a function. But you see that you immediately find some problems when you try to extend this definition to manifolds. So one question is, what do you on a manifold, what do you take as t0? So you might think, well, as a t0, I'll take just one point p on my manifold. But then the question is, what do you take as t0 plus s? So is it p plus delta p? So if you have on a manifold, you have p. And then where do I write p plus delta p? Okay, how do I decide which way I go? Where do I go? And so how do you compare something at p and delta p? Okay, so that's a problem. Another problem is that, for example, if you want to differentiate a tangent vector, so you know that one vector space is a tangent to my p here. But at p and delta p, I have another tangent vector space, which in general has nothing to do with the first one. They are completely two separate vector spaces, and there's no way to connect them. Okay, so these are the problems which you have to actually solve. And basically, the result is there is no solution for this. Okay, so how to... That's true. But still, you don't know how to go to p plus delta p. You don't know how to do that. And you don't know how to carry. So what you are doing here is you are comparing the function which, is at one point with a function at another point. So what you have to do is basically you have to sort of carry your vector field from one point to another point and then compare them, right? And in general, there's no way how to do that. Okay, so problem is how to compare a vector at p plus delta p with a vector at p. If you can even define what p plus delta p actually means. So that's the problem which you encounter in the manifold. And as I say, in general, there is no solution. So to actually do this, you need an additional structure in the manifold. So to do this, need an additional structure. Okay, in the manifold, and that has to be given to you. So if you don't have that, you simply cannot define, what you mean by differentiation of vector field. So now, for this additional structure, there are three very useful and common options you have. So three common possibilities. I will try to discuss two of them in this course, and then starting relativity course, you will discuss the third one. So the first possibility is the Lie derivative. And for that, in order to define what a Lie derivative is, you need an extra, the extra structure which you need is an extra vector field, which already lives in your manifold. So you need a vector field, which is already given there, U. So if you have that vector field on your manifold, then yes, you can differentiate. Another possibility is so-called exterior derivative. So for this, you sort of don't need an additional structure, but it's defined on very, very restricted set of objects, which are called forms. So defined not on all tensors, but on very, very special tensors, defined only on forms. And the third possibility, which I'm not going to do, and which is the most complicated one, but the first one people usually see, is the covariant derivative. And for this, in order to define covariant derivative, you need a connection on your manifold. And if you have taken some course on general relativity or whatever, you know that this connection is usually denoted gamma. Okay, so the first one, the first option is very, very simple, and I'll now do it. The second one is also relatively simple. I will do it later. The third one is the most difficult concept. The covariant derivatives is really a nasty beast. But why people see it for the, you know, when that's the first thing people see, because it's very extremely useful for general relativity. So, you know, you will see that in the relativity course, but I'm not going to discuss covariant derivative at all in this course, and we don't need it. So these two we will do. Okay, questions? Okay, so now we want to do the Lie derivative, and I told you that we need a vector field already given on your manifold. So a vector field is a very powerful thing, and why it is powerful is that it actually penetrates, sort of, it allows you to penetrate your manifold with a map. And that map corresponds to integral curves of this vector field. Okay? So a vector field U defines its integral curves on the manifold M. And so what is an integral curve is that their tangent vector, coincides with this vector field at each point, with U at P for all P. So what it means is that if this is, you know, piece of my manifold, then I can, if I am given a vector field U, I can actually find curves which belong to this manifold, such that at each point, if I take a tangent vector to that curve, it's precisely given by my U at that point. So for a given P, this is my UP. So given a vector field, I can find these curves, gamma, everywhere on the manifold. Okay? So to prove this, So what you require, you will play with the tangent vector field again today in your tutorial. But let's say in coordinates, you will see that the tangent vector, so this gamma is a curve, and in given coordinates is described by x mu of t. So I know what x1 of t is, x2 of t is, and t is the parameter which goes from that interval from yesterday. Okay, so now if I want a tangent vector, I want actually to compare. So I'm interested in how these coordinates change as you change t. Okay, so what do you define? It's basically dx mu over dt is given by the component of the vector field here. So I know this guy. This is given to me. I know what, in a given coordinate system what the components of the vector are. And then I can find, I'm trying to find this x mu of t. But of course, this is a set of linear equations, the partial differential equations. And so this has a unique solution x mu of t. So indeed, you can find these curves given a vector field. Okay. Very good. So if I have a vector field, I can find these curves. But then if I have curves, I can actually define a map on the manifold. I can actually move along these curves, let's say from this point to that point. And there is a way how to map one point to another point. So now I know what delta p is. I just move infinitesimally along this the given curve for a given p. Okay, so this defines a map. It's called phi of t, which is a map from manifold to itself by phi of t. I start at one point and go to a later point. Okay. So a picture, so I have one gamma here, another gamma here. So let's say I have point P here, point Q here, and this corresponds to T0. So this is a point of gamma T0 here. There's another gamma at T0 here, point Q. And then I can actually, by this phi of T, I just move to T0 plus T. And so I assign to point P some point P tilde, and to point Q some point Q tilde. And this is defined everywhere in the manifold. So this is the action of phi of t. OK, does it make sense? Very good. So now, this phi, because it comes from the vector field, which is nice and smooth and everything, this map phi has extremely nice properties. Okay, so I added some notes on, well, general notes in the study text, and you can read about it. You know, you can have different maps in manifolds, you know, mapping one manifold to another one and so on. And depending how nice this map is, you can do different things. So in general, so I'm taking now at one point to another point along the curve. But it may happen that at that point, I also have a vector. And if I'm lucky, I can drag this vector along that curve and find another vector at another point. Okay, so that's the aim I want to do. In general, this is not possible if the map is bad behave. But this map is nicely behaved. Okay, so the properties of the map is that phi of t, so it is continuous in t, so it's t continuous. continuous. Another property that if I have file 0, that's equal to an identity. If I take phi t plus s, it's just phi of t composed with phi of s. And most importantly, you have also an inverse. So if I go with respect to a negative parameter minus t, then this is like going the other direction. Okay. So, and so t is a continuous parameter, and I can go this way or I can go that way. And that's usually not the case with a general map. You can go only one way with general map. But here you have the inverse. So what it actually means, that all these properties, it means that phi defines a one parametric, I have one parameter t, so one parametric, Lie means it's continuous. There's a famous guy, Lie. I will have the whole course on Lie groups and Lie algebras with Gong. So, but what it means is actually that t is continuous. Okay. Defines one parametric Lie, group of diffeomorphisms. And so this is basically all you can wish for. So what is a diffeomorphism more generally? So I can have a diffeomorphism so it's a map from one manifold to an isomorphic manifold, but let's say a different manifold, which is one on one, on two, and has its inverse and its smooth. So that's what a diffeomorphism is. And the map defined by this vector field U is actually a diffeomorphism. So it's everything you can wish for. You have the nicest map ever. Okay. So now if you have such a nice map, you can not only map the points from one point to another, but you can also drag the vector fields along that field. Okay. So one can define, and I don't know if this is the correct thing from C++, but maybe it is, overload it it's something like overloaded operators or something like operation operation let's call it phi star. So it's not exactly phi, but it's something which can be derived from your map phi, which maps basically tensors, any tensor on M to a tensor on M tilde. So if you have a diffeomorphism, if you have a nice map, then you can not only drag the points from one manifold to another, but also all tensor fields. Okay, so in particular, I can carry a vector field from point Q to a vector field in point Q tilde. Okay, and there is a unique way how to do that. Okay, so does it make sense? Yes? No, but what this is a property of the map, right? It may be possible that I don't have a continuous map. Let's say probably not possible, but okay. But anyway, it can happen, for example, that all the points of the manifold are mapped to one point, for example. Oh, I don't know. But yeah, so but here is definitely continuous. But, yeah. Yeah. Well, think about counterexample. Yeah. If you can have some discrete or something that is screwed up, I think you can. Okay, so given the vector field, we have the integral curves, and given the integral curves, we know how to actually map tensors from one point on the manifold to another point on the manifold. Okay, so now we can use this. So definition. So let phi of t be a one parametric group of diffeomorphisms. Diffeomorphisms generated by you. By my vector field u. Then the Lie derivative and is denoted by L, well, LU, L standing for Lie, with respect to the this vector field U is defined as that. So L U of T, T is my tensor field at given point P, is just the limit T goes to zero, and then the tensor field, which is at that given point, minus the tensor field, which I carried to that point from a different point. That's the definition. So now I really know how to find a new P tilde or Q tilde. I just move along that curve. And I know how to drag the tensor with me. So I can really take, you know, I have a tensor here, let's say vector here, and I just carry it to a new point. I get another vector. And now I look at the tensor which was already there. And I compare the two and subtract them and get a derivative. Yes?
Why are you saying let phi t be a one parameter group? Isn't it unique?
Sure. B, if you want. Thanks.
So if I have to calculate that, how do I find the phi t star?
Very good. You will do it in today's tutorial. But I'll give you the result now. So, but anyway, so what this means is that if I schematically write this, I said what was there I'll give you an example. Minus what I transported there. And that's the definition of the Lie derivative. Okay, so let me just give you an example. The simplest one, let's do a Lie derivative of a function. So example, L U of a function f. So by definition, this is just limit t goes to zero. Let's say I calculate this at point t0. So now what I transported there over t. Okay. So now how do I transport a function from one point to another? right? So I have this, let's say I have a function at this point, this is my gamma, right? And I want to transport that function to a nearby point, t plus t0 or whatever. Okay, so how do I do it? What do you think? So, huh? Exactly. So this is my transported thing, but what you do, so this is f of t0, but what you do is that you say, well, I just transport the same value from this point to that point. So f of t0 is just f of t0 minus t. Okay, so this is f t0 minus t. Now, this is what I transported there, but I just transport the value. I carry that value with me along the vector field. And now you compare it with what is actually here. So there's already f of t0 there. I just compare the values of f of t0 and the thing I transported there. Okay, so what it is, okay, so this is just f of t0 minus f of t0 minus t over t, which is just screwed up definition of a differential. So this is equal to df over dt. Okay, so now I can write this in a concrete coordinate system. So this is df over, yeah. dx mu over dt, df over dx mu. So now this is my parametrization of the curve. And its tangent vector is u mu. Okay. So this is equal to u mu df over dx mu. But this is nothing else than u acting on my function f. Okay. So this is how you lead transport a function. And yeah, if you are interested, there's a problem in your today's tutorial how to do for a vector or for other things. But let me give you the result. Okay. Questions to this? Okay, so now the result. So let me state some properties of this Lie derivative. So LU maps KL tensors to KL tensors. So in particular here, we have Lie transported a function, and in the end, we got a function. Okay. So it is linear, as always, as any derivative is, preserves contraction. Well, you will see what that means in your tutorial. It is a derivative, so it means it obeys the Leibniz rule. Well, LU T tensor S is LU of T S plus T LU of S. So you already know how it acts on a function. So L U on a function is just U of F. funny part is how it acts on a vector. And it's actually a beautiful thing. So LU on a vector is given by a commutator of the two vectors, which is defined as U V minus V U. So this is called commutator. Or sometimes it is called Lie bracket. Okay. So now basically knowing these two things, you can define what Lie derivative is on any tensor. So because it preserves the contraction, you can contract V with a corresponding one form, omega. You get a function, so you know what Lie derivative of that is. You know what Lie derivative of a vector is. And by this tensor Leibniz rule, you can find what the Lie derivative of a one form is. Okay. But more generally, if I just write, well, I don't know if I want to write it. I'll write it. So let me just write a general expression for any tensor, but in components. So if I have a tensor, it has some components up and some components down, then what it is just you take the vector field and differentiate the tensor. So there's a partial differentiation of the tensor. So this is dx gamma, and nu gamma. And then there's some minuses and pluses. So it's if you differentiate, then you differentiate each index separately. So if you differentiate index up, you have minus sign. So it's minus, and so you replace that index with the one of the vector field. So it's t gamma and beta, and then dx gamma u alpha minus, and so on, for all the upper indices. And then you have plus for the lower indices, so you have t, alpha, and gamma. So now I'm replacing this index, the beta with gamma, and dx beta u gamma. So this is the general formula in components, how you do a Lie derivative thing. So you know, don't memorize it, just find it somewhere. Okay. So now, why is Lie derivative so interesting? Is because it depends only on this vector field. But you see that, for example, if you impose that Lie derivative of a tensor equals to something, then actually it can give you, so if you know the tensor already, it gives you some differential equation on a vector field U. Okay, so this, so if let's say I equal this something which I know or prescribe, let's say zero, then this is a differential equation for your vector field U. So now this is used for symmetries. So for the use of the Lie derivatives is for the symmetries. And so Lie derivative plays, you know, a key role for defining symmetries. And so let's say I have, so given a tensor T, it may be possible to find, one might find corresponding vector field U, so that the Lie derivative of the tensor is equal to zero. Okay. It may not always be possible, but sometimes it is possible. Okay. So however, what this means? It means that as I drag the tensor along this vector field, the tensor actually is exactly equal to what was already there. So the tensor doesn't change along that direction, right? So if I can do this, so this defines a very special direction U, along which t does not change. So really what I drag there is what was already there. So I'm not learning anything new. So I have a symmetry for t. So that people say that this is, you know, so U defines a symmetry for my given tensor field. Okay, so I have a symmetry. And you know, this symmetry not always exists. So you must have something, you know, something must be special so that this symmetry actually exists, right? So maybe you are familiar, if you've taken some general relativity courses, you are probably familiar with symmetries of the metric, which are called isometries. So these are just special case of this, where you take the tensor to be a metric tensor. But you know, this is much more general than just for the metric. Okay. Questions?
So it's not true that, like, if I let the direction vary, I get a tensor of one higher rank, right? Because, like, it seems like you need to know the vector field in an entire neighborhood in order to do this.
You need to know the vector field, yeah, everywhere. Yeah. But it maps the tensors to the same rank tensors, this thing here, which, you know, in components, you can see it easily here. That, you know, on the left-hand side, I have components of T, alpha, beta, and on the right-hand side, alpha only. Yeah. All right. So now we are in trouble. So this was the simplest possible derivative in the manifold, and all you need is a vector field. So let me start now the second possibility, and that is if you have differential forms. We have time till 1 p.m., right? Because then I have to play squash. So and you probably need to go for lunch. So part C, differential forms. And I will do it, you know, not very rigorously, but it's okay. So definition. A differential so before we had one form, so now we'll have a P form where P is one or bigger or zero. Okay, P form omega is a totally antisymmetric tensor of type 0 and P. Okay, so that means that in components I have P indices, which are downstairs because it's 0 P tensor, so alpha 1 to alpha P, which are totally antisymmetric, meaning that if I swap the two indices, I get a minus sign. Any two indices, I get a minus sign. So this is usually denoted by brackets like this, alpha 1, alpha P. So these brackets stand for antisymmetrization. So if I completely antisymmetrize, I get the same object. And so how this is defined is that I take some stupid prefactor 1 over P factorial, and then you sum over all permutations of the indices So you sum over permutation P pi, and you take the sign of that permutation, and then you sum over these indices alpha pi 1, alpha pi p. Okay, so an example, if I have omega alpha beta antisymmetrized, it's just 1/2 omega alpha beta minus omega beta alpha. Okay, so you're taking the sign of the permutation. So for example, if I have 1, 2, 3, I assign a sign 1. Then if I have 1, 3, 2, then it will be minus 1. So that's what the sign means here. So I'm just really counting plus or minus thing. And then I'm taking all these permutations of the indices here. Okay. So a form, again, so a form is a 0p tensor, but it's completely antisymmetric. Okay, if I swap any two indices, I get a minus sign. So now, if you define, so let's denote lambda p at x a vector space. So this again, these things form a vector space. Of p forms at x. Okay.
So can you tell me how big this vector space is? So you're basically asking, you know, I have an object living, let's say, in n dimensions with p indices which are all completely antisymmetric. Do you know what the dimension of this thing is? You are basically asking, you know, so these objects are determined by, you know, how many different indices, different p indices I can have in n dimensions, and it's a combinatorial number, m over p. Okay, so in particular, if you have an n form in n dimensions, it's just one. So now we can define some operations with these objects. So this is a definition of a form, but let's do some for definition. A vector product so is denoted by this funny sign. It's like a tensor product, but it has some extra property. So it's a map from lambda p times lambda q to lambda p plus q. So similarly, as the tensor product increases the rank of a tensor, so does the wedge product. But it does have the property that you start this antisymmetric object, you product it with another antisymmetric object, and you get again an antisymmetric object. So the only way how you can do that is that you antisymmetrize everything in the end. Okay, so definition is basically, I take one thing, I take another thing. So I have p form, omega, q form, mu. And if I take the components, so alpha 1, alpha p, beta 1, beta q, then this is given by some funny fit factor, which you will discuss tomorrow. This p plus q factorial over p factorial q factorial. So that's
omega, alpha 1, alpha p, nu, beta 1, beta q. You take the tensor product of that, and then you come to the Young's contrives. Take a product, tensor product, and then you know, this is what you mean by a vector product. So omega with nu is a p plus q form. So this is if you want to swap the q, then you pick up some minus sign. P q nu omega. Then particularly if you have both forms which are the same, so let's say I have omega 1, veg omega 1, it's not equal to 0. Or omega 3, omega 3. So if you have the same one forms because of this property, you get V to 0. Okay? So now, the wedge product actually means that I can write any p-form as a linear combination of wedge products of the basis of one forms. So since dx alpha is a coordinate basis of one form, any p form can be written as p form omega can be written as omega equals to, again, this one of the factors is sort of, it's a definition, if you want, omega alpha 1 alpha p dx alpha 1 wedge dx alpha p. Again, this is the basis of forms. And those are components. And it's besides this 1 over p factorial is the origin of that prefactor p plus q factorial, p factorial and q factorial, as you will show tomorrow. Okay, so we have a wedge product. So we now know how to tensor product two forms, but in such a way that actually we get another form, not the general. If you just did a tensor product on two forms, you will get a tensor but not another form. It will not be anti-symmetric, it will be anti-symmetric in all the instances. That's why you have to anti-symmetrize. Okay. Maybe you can do it. Not a half an hour. So we have a wedge product. Now that is another, if you want to differentiate the form. And there's basically two ways how to differentiate forms, where one of them is actually not really a differentiation. So one is called inner derivative. So for a vector, so if you have a vector field B, then you define inner derivative.
A vector or a vector field?
Well, for me, they are the same. So, vector field, yeah. Inner derivative, it's called inner for the given vector field, and it takes a p form to p minus one form. And how it is done is that, so you take omega. Sometimes I'll use a notation of who. This is very, very mathematical notation, so physicists don't like this. So physicists usually put dot. It doesn't matter, but what it means is that you take the first slot of the form and feed it the vector, and then you leave all the slots untouched. So it means that in components, B hook oh my god, you will have now one less component. So it's alpha 1, alpha p minus 1 is given by v beta, omega beta, alpha 1, alpha p minus 1. So you basically eat, you fill the first law, you eat one thing, and then you end up with a p minus 1. And so properties of this are that ID is linear, it's also linear in B, so by linear it means when it acts on something, by linear in B it means, you know, I can take a linear combination alpha B plus beta W, and it's still true. It satisfies the Leibniz rule, that's why it is a derivative. Although you are not differentiating anything really. Which means that for omega lambda p, we have that IV omega vex nu. So if I have two things which are product here, and I take an inner derivative here, then this is just inner derivative on the first one times the second one. But this is graded, it means that it's not exactly the Leibniz rule as you know it, but there's a minus sign coming into the play. So it's minus 2 power p omega which I u. IB nu. Okay, so that's the second part of it. So it's not really Leibniz, but if you want, it's graded Leibniz. Graded. So there's this minus sign, which depends on the rank of the tensor. Okay, and the last property is that if you take IB and IW, and then you take the other way around, you get zero. So in particular, IB squared. Questions? So this is really not a derivative, but because it satisfies the Leibniz property, people call it derivative. Okay. Right. So that's an inner derivative. So now there's another derivative which actually already is a derivative, and that's the exterior derivative. Takes a p form to p plus 1 form. And it's defined as follows. So if you differentiate a function, you get one form. So on a function you get a differential, just df over dx alpha, dx alpha, and this you already know it's a one form. Right? So now from this definition you see that basically these base the basis of one forms is a differential on a coordinate. Okay. And then on a p-form, omega. So you can use the fact that you can write the p-form in the form which is somewhere. So p acting on omega, you get p of omega 1 over p factorial, and then you differentiate the components omega alpha 1 and alpha p. And then you wedge that with the basis. Okay. So now, of course, each component is just a function. So when I'm differentiating with a function, I'm getting a one form. And so now I wedge that with the original basis of p forms. So I get a p plus one form. And again, you will show in your tutorial tomorrow that p omega alpha 1 alpha p plus 1 in components is just p plus 1 p alpha 1 omega alpha 2 alpha p plus 1, and then it unsymmetrized everything. Now, a very important property is that d squared equals to 0. So if you apply d and d, again, on the same form, then you get 0. And this you may know in terms of, you know, vector calculus, something like gradient of rotation, something like it's equal to 0. Okay. So now, is this interesting cohomology. So this definition, so you say alpha is closed. When d alpha equals to 0. It's a definition. Then you say beta, well, okay, alpha is exact. And it is written as a differential of something else. Right. So now, obviously, if something is exact, means alpha equals to d beta, then d of alpha is d squared on beta, which is equal to 0. So exact implies both. An exact form must be also a closed form. Is the converse true? Almost this. Okay. So if you want to do the other way around, so closed, so there's a, how is it called? Is it called? Some lemma. Well, anyway. Some lemma. Saying that any closed form alpha can be locally written as alpha d beta. So any closed form is locally exact, but there may be some local obstruction to that. And it's an interesting nice piece of topic. So there's a global obstruction, but locally you can always do that. So that's why you can write this sort of field strength of electromagnetic field as a derivative of a vector potential. Right? So locally you can do that. And I have 1 minute. So now the most important lemma for all of classical mechanics. and it's something which you probably are already familiar with. And it's called Cartan's lemma. And for those interested, I put a proof of this in tomorrow's tutorial. But you don't need to know how to prove it, but you need to know how to use it. Follows from this level. Okay, so here and continue.